Hey, are you ready to move your life? I mean, really move it? It's time to turn up the dial on your energy, your health, your sport performance, your happiness, and your relationships. If you want to live with more freedom, more adventure, more passion, more fun, and more success, if you're ready to get your brain in the game and achieve the most out of every area of your life, then it's time to move to live and live to move with your host, Jill Summers.
Hello, you made it, you're here, you are in the right place if you're ready to dial up your life. This is Jill with Jill M. Summers Performance Coaching, and this podcast is designed to guide, coach, support, and challenge you to live your life out loud. Yep, I mean way out loud. Today, I want to tell you a little story. Back in 1978, three guys were sitting around discussing who was the better athlete, the swimmer, the biker, or the runner. And in the end, they decided to put together a challenge which birthed a athletic movement that has taken the world by storm called Ironman. And today I am super excited to have with me on my interview Dave Orlowski, who is one of those original three men who created this amazing...
One of the 15 men... That did the race.
That ended up doing the race. So, Dave, welcome to our interview today.
Thank you, Jill.
It's so
exciting. Very excited to be here.
Ah.
As we talked a little bit earlier, I love sharing the experience to people because they don't realize what or how Ironman started, because all they see is what it is now with the thousands of people doing it, aid stations, you know, race bikes and everything else. So it's always a great experience that I can compare what it was in 1978 to what it is now, and me myself having done it under both types of environments, that I have the experience to be able to share that of what the experience is now. So
tell us, I'm super excited to hear about, and I want the listeners to hear about what that was all about way back in 1978, and you guys are just sitting around discussing who's the better athlete.
Well, I wasn't part of that discussion. I was at the awards banquet, which was held at the Primo Beer Gardens on the island of Oahu. And we had just completed a running event, and I was part of a military team. So there was an awards party there. And part of this awards party, one of my people that was on my team, his name's Tom Knoll, was an ultra-distance runner. Well, the Navy part of it was, there was an individual by the name of John Collins, Commander John Collins. And if his name sounds familiar, he is the creator of what was started in 1978. John Collins was a cyclist and a runner. And then there was a guy by the name of John Dunbar that was a Navy SEAL, and he was a swimmer. So during this argument, these guys were all in their 40s going, I always say, through a midlife crisis and arguing who is the fittest athlete. John Collins came to a decision to say, okay, there's three main events on the island of Oahu every year. There's a 2.4 rough water ocean swim, which is still there. It's called the Waikiki Rough Water Swim, and that's held in September. There's a bike race that was a two-day race, which was a perimeter bike race, and that was 114 miles. The reason Ironman is at 112, so in order for you to finish the bike race and do the third part of what John Collins proposed, being the Honolulu Marathon, you had to start 2 miles before the finish of the bike race at the start of the Honolulu Marathon, because he wanted all three events to be done. So he took 2 miles off the bike race to start at the Aloha Tower. So John Collins stood up and he proposed a challenge to everybody that, you know, we're going to do this event. It's going to be February 18th, 1978. And that anybody who finishes will be called an Ironman and will have bragging rights for life. In 1978, the event was actually called the Hawaiian Ironman triathlon, and Ironman was segmented as two words, mm-hmm. Iron and Man. So there was about 7 weeks from December till February of 78, December of 77 till February of 1978 that people had a chance to get their training on and do it. Now, keep in mind, training back then is not training as we see it now. There isn't such a thing as coaches. There wasn't diets, nutrition, aero bikes, or anything of that nature. So you went to the race with what you had.
And I've seen pictures of what you had. I've seen this bike that you... Did you say you borrowed this bike?
I did borrow the bike for it.
And how many
That's kind
miles?
Of my trademark as me for doing the event. A week before this event of, you know, on February 18th of 78, I still hadn't ridden a bike. I wasn't a cyclist.
A week before the race.
The race.
You were going to do 114 miles
112,
back then.
112.
Okay, you were going to do 12.
Yeah, I still hadn't ridden a bike. I still didn't have a bike. So
okay.
I started, I was in the Marine Corps, so I started asking fellow Marines, has anybody got a bicycle I could borrow? And one of my fellow Marines said, well, I've got this Sears Free Spirit that I've basically never ridden. So it was basically a department store Sears Free Spirit bicycle with nothing, with bottle cages, nothing for nutrition or anything like that. So I rode it about 30 miles just to make sure I could set it up to get the seat and everything in position. And the night before, we were having a discussion as to, with the support crew of how they were going to support us. And because our crew was supporting three people, there was a possibility that I wouldn't see them. And one thing that you also have to understand, there were no people giving you directions on the course, no volunteers. It was basically you went out there and it was a solo event. So John Collins gives you two sheets of paper with the directions for the bike course, and off you went on race day. So my decision at that point was I cut off a pair of blue jeans. I had blue jean shorts. I put the bike course in one pocket, and I put money in the other pocket because I didn't have water bottles or food on the bike. So I had to stop as often as I could whenever I didn't see these people. And, you know, so I came out of the swim. I put the bike shorts over my salty Speedo, and off I went. So as I tell people, anybody that wants to have an argument on chafing, I'll be the first to debate chafing with people.
I hear a new product coming up, the Dave Orlowski Chafing Cream.
Yeah.
I think it's hilarious. I'm over here laughing my head off because I'm remembering back in 2015, I did an Ironman race in Majorca, but none of my gear showed up for 5 days. And we literally had to make the decision, what were we going to do? Because I had to turn in my bike in the next 48 hours, and I didn't have a bike. And so we're like, well, do I go rent one? And I'm freaking out because I'm thinking, how am I going to ride a bike? I've never ridden before. And here you are. You had only put in 30 miles, and you were going to ride a bike from Sears, of course, that you had never ridden.
Yeah, 30-some-pound bike, yeah. Well, you know, the funny thing was, as I tell people then and I tell people now, oh, geez, I rode a bicycle as a kid. I can ride a bike 112 miles. What's the big deal? Well, until you get on a bike, and as many of you know now, being athletes and that, there's a lot more to it than just jumping on a bike and riding 112. There's 112 miles is a long distance.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot to be said, too, for just being young and sort of naive and
right.
going, oh, whatever, I'll do what I have to do to get through it.
I think you hit the nail on the head when you said naive. In 1978, we were naive. No, first of all, nobody thought that this was humanly possible, that a body could right. withstand this amount of exercise in a day to complete an event. So nobody ever thought that anybody was going to finish. So this was a personal challenge. This wasn't a race. Many people use the term race. And in 1978, it wasn't a race. And I tell people now still, it's still a personal challenge. It's a race for the pros in that because they race for money. It's a race for age group athletes if they're trying to get a Kona slot. But for the pros, the people going for Kona slots, and everybody on the course, when you're out there on that day, it's still a personal challenge. Your personal challenge is to do your best and to do your best and get to the finish line and either win, place, or go to Kona, whatever your goal is that mm-hmm. day.
And I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind. That's number one. It's your own personal challenge.
Right, it's your personal
challenge.
Sometimes
that gets skewed with some of these other goals, which we can talk about later.
Right.
Absolutely. So you borrowed a bike. Were you a swimmer to begin with?
I was a swimmer in high school.
And you were able to swim this distance?
Yeah. I the only things that I did is I swam, and I'd done my first marathon, being the Honolulu Marathon in December of 77. And I was, because I was in the Marines, I was in great shape, and mm-hmm. they beat you into shape, just jokingly, but they have a high standard for physical fitness because of the rigors of what your job is there.
So there were 15 people who did the original race. All
men, right, there were 15 people that signed up.
All men. Okay, and did they all finish?
No. Three people did not finish. There were 12 people that finished it. I was third place in the first one, even though all our trophies just say finisher, but my claim to fame in a podium at an Ironman is the first one. There was no podium, there was no places or anything like that, but that was my podium and my claim to fame.
If my memory serves me right, you actually did it in a great time.
I did it in 13 hours and 59 minutes. And I think what's even more amazing when you look at my times, my bike was right, I think it was in the 650s, and my swim was like a 107, something like that, you know. But I think more importantly is the way we did the bike. Like I say, I had a 30-pound bike. I stopped at grocery stores, ran in without a shirt on, just had a visor on for my so-called aero helmet at that time. I stopped at gas stations. I even ate at a McDonald's. So I look at my bike time saying, you know, when you look at things in perspective, I was averaging 16.5 miles an hour, you know, on a bike between 16.5 and 17 miles an hour and making all these stops and sitting down. So I probably, you know, in today's day and age, I probably would have had a pretty good bike
right.
on an aero bike and, you know, set upright and everything else.
It's true, so you can buy speed. I know we talked
about
that.
Buy speed. You
can
buy speed.
These days you can buy speed
yep.
for sure.
Yep.
And you were stopping at McDonald's for
I even ate at a McDonald's, meal. Sat down and had yeah. a meal at a McDonald's.
What, like a Big Mac with some French fries?
I do remember, I'm not sure if I had a Big Mac or, you know, a cheeseburger or something like that. I can't remember. Remember that, but I distinctly remember because I had been drinking so much Coke and water that I did have a vanilla shake and I did have salty French fries.
And again, it's just so funny because as iron athletes, you know, we dial in the nutrition
right.
and it's got to be really pure and clean, and I just love that. So dialing in nutrition, you know, iron athletes are always concerned about how many calories they're getting and what kind of calories they're getting, and yes, such a juxtaposition. So tell us about what was the run like? You got off the bike, you had your cutoff jean shorts on.
Well, I did take the cutoff jean shorts and I did take off the Speedo. I was really shaped, and I believe I wore the same shoes because I just wore a tennis shoe on the bike.
Sure.
And didn't have clip, you know, cages or anything for that. So I think I wore the same tennis shoes on the run that I had on the bike, but I did put on running shorts and just, you know, no shirt or singlets. I mean, it was hot, you know, Hawaii's hot.
Sure.
So after I changed, they had a changing tent right at the Aloha Tower. I came out and I literally fell down, and I continued to fall down as I tried to walk for a good period of time. Because what was happening is now you train for what's called bricks. Back then, there was no science to this. So my legs and body didn't know how to respond together to get myself running. So as I tell people, it probably took a mile and a half to 2 miles for my legs and body and brain to get to work together to get my legs running in that, because like I say, I literally fell down. So I'd pick myself up, I'd walk, I'd fall down again. And not hard, falling hard, but I realized that I couldn't. Once the legs got going, then I started running real well.
Yeah.
Till about mile 17. Just like in a marathon, mile 17 to 22 comes along and I hit a wall, you know, and had a wall for 17 to 22 miles.
And were you supported in the run back then? Were they?
I did have the support there, because now they were able to stay closer together to us to some degree.
Right.
But there were times that I didn't get to see them, so I just run into a gas station and, you know, use the facilities, or, you know, get a drink of water and stuff. I didn't have money on that, so, you know, I basically drank, you know, the water out of the sink, or, you know, if that was available to me, so.
So you finished the race and you came into third. You came in third. And then what were some of the comments that were made back then about now who was the best athlete, the swimmer, the biker, the runner?
You know, there really wasn't any comments on that. I think everybody pretty much finished and felt like crap and died for the next week, because not only was your GI system screwed up, I mean, when you really think of what Ironman does, it's probably one of the worst things on your body, in that I have a bad immune system. I have leukemia. I've had it for almost 7 years now. But the worst thing for your body is to stress it to the points that you do with Ironman. So back then, not having any knowledge on nutrition or anything like that, the things that I put in my body, being Hershey bars, Coca-Cola, orange juice, you know, when you look at the mix of all that with the acids and stuff like that, and, you know, the Coke and, you know, the carbonation, you know, my GI system was just a mess for about 4 or 5 days, as well as the body. You know, there wasn't things like taking protein to, you know, for your muscles to recover. You just kind of went out and ate. And, you know, back then, it's no different than now. I'm sure everybody has the same thing, is for that week after, your body just kind of crashes. So all of a sudden, you're like looking for like a sugar, or, you know, you're like eating to, you know, so your body puts on a little bit of weight in the next week after, because you're recovering and your body's craving certain things that you've been training with, and, you know, the sugars, you know, the carbs and the sugars.
Right, right. So you went through your recovery, and this new Ironman triathlon had been born. How long was it before they did another event like that?
It was the next year, 1979.
They did one the next
year. Yeah.
So they kept on with the...
Well, they did, and I was actually signed up for the second year, and I went there. And the history on the second year is we all showed up, and there was, you know, a major storm that came through. And so it was just not safe to go out on the swim. If you look at the pictures in the books and everything else, there were about 200 people, I think, the history says, showed up on the first day. And, you know, it's pretty much a democratic process. You know, okay, we're not going to do it today. Will you all come back tomorrow? And the next day I went back, and I had been getting sick and feverish and that, and realized what it done to my body the previous year. So I just didn't do it, supported people that were doing it. And only about, I think it was 40 officially, the book says, showed up, you know, in the history of it. It says that 40 people, and the first female, Lynn Lemire, was the first female did it that year. So, and then it continued on every
continued
year after
and,
that.
And grew. Yeah. And moved
and it grew.
To
yeah.
the Big Island.
Correct, in 81.
Okay.
They had two races. Because the event was growing, the island of Oahu was so touristy and packed with people, and that they realized that they had to take it to a place where it wouldn't interfere a lot with traffic and people. And, you know, it's a long day event. So they took it to the Big Island. They had the first race in 1981 in February on Oahu. And then they moved it also, they moved it to October of 81. To the Big Island. And one of the reasons too that they moved it to that October event is that they thought, many people thought, it was an unfair advantage, from what I hear in rumors, many thought it was an unfair advantage to the people that lived in warmer climates to be able to go to a February race and compete compared to athletes that had winter. So they thought that they could level things out and make it a fairer, you know, for the pros and for the athletes.
Right. That's interesting. So fast forward to the year 2008. That's when I first met you.
Yes.
And we actually met on a riding event.
Yes.
We went to the Wisconsin Ironman course to ride the course.
Yes.
And we were riding that course together because you were going to do what?
I was going to come back after 30 years of not doing Ironman and say, geez, can I do this again?
Wow. So you
and
did
so
your,
I was super you, excited, but I had been fat, out of shape, and had a shoulder replacement, so I had to teach myself to swim again. I had to buy a bike and learn how to really be, as I always called myself, bicycling. And Dave Scott says, no, once you start riding a bike, you're considered a cyclist now, Dave. So now I consider myself a cyclist.
Yes.
And try to have a hone a few running skills again.
So how old were you in 78 when you did your first one?
22.
And then you came back 30 years later to do your next one, which was also the 25th anniversary, is that right? 30th anniversary, okay. Obviously, it's 30 years later. And now you're going to be taking this on again, but now we have all these new, cool, fandangled nuances and coaching opportunities and foods and bikes and clothing and all that. So you get to experience it from a completely different angle. What was that like?
I feel that when I went back in 2008, that I was no different than any other first-time Ironman triathlete doing it. I bought a triathlon bike. I had wetsuits for open water swimming, but I really didn't do that much open water swimming with a wetsuit because I knew that going in Hawaii, I'd be swimming, you know, without a wetsuit. I didn't have a coach. I didn't study nutrition like the people, you know, building up to it. I developed some stuff by talking to people and pretty much trying to figure out what my body would use and work the best on race day. So I talked to a lot of athletes. I talked to, you know, I talked to people that were coaches. I talked to people like at Power Bar where they figured out like a sweat rate for me so I would know how much sodium and stuff like that I would need, how much potassium. But I did use the science in building myself up to do this race now, to do it as a first-time athlete in that. And as a first-time athlete coming back, there were two things that really stuck in my mind in reading. And I think these are two things that are important to other first-time athletes is, first of all, Paul Anubi Frazier had a statement in one of the triathlon magazines. And she says, if you're doing your first triathlon, she says, really, you should just take off your watch and enjoy the day. Experience the whole event is for what it is. Enjoy the volunteers, enjoy the bike ride, you know, enjoy the run and stuff. She says you can always come back and race a second time and race for PRs, Kona, or whatever you're deciding. And let me think what the Lance Armstrong statement was for what people, whatever your views are on Lance Armstrong. I'm not making a political statement here and that. But he made a statement, something that just stuck in my mind. It says, quitting, there was something about quitting, but finishing is forever. And that's such a true statement. No matter what you do, keep moving forward, get to the finish line, and finish, because that's a forever memory for you.
Yeah. I think that's such a great message. I know that's basically what I had decided to do on my first race, which was 2008, that year that I had met you. And we probably had this conversation. And my guess is you may have been the one who planted the idea in my mind. And that was my first race, I was just going to be out there and enjoy it. I was going to enjoy my friends and family that were on the course. I was going to get pictures. I was going to do what I had to do in transition. In fact, transition T2 was 20 minutes. I took 20 minutes. I changed all of my clothes. I brushed my hair. I washed my face.
Oh, we have to look.
I got a little back massage. My friend.
That's a woman thing, you know. It's not how you go, it's how you look.
I wasn't so concerned about how I looked, but my back was hurting. I'm like, I'm going to be out on this run for another 5 hours or something, and I got to feel good. And my friends, they still tease me to this day. They're like, Jill, what the heck were you doing in there?
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because I change now. And, you know, to me, every race, I've done 29 of them. And every race I do, I try to make it fun. I'm not worried about, you know, my times and PRs and stuff like that. So when, you know, I'm on the bike course, I ride by people and stuff like that, or people ride by me. Hey, how's your day going? You having a good day and stuff like that. And they look at you and they give you that look like, how can this guy be so happy out here and stuff like that? Or, you know, stop at the aid stations and thank the volunteers. Or on the run, you know, I'd say my best run now is a 50% run, 50% walk. And, you know, I'm in that 14 to 16 hour range. And you just meet the greatest people walking and telling stories. And I don't tell people who I am or anything like that until maybe later on in, you know, in a conversation. And, you know, so it's great listening to the stories of why people are out there doing it and stuff, you know. And
I'm always struck with that, because I think if I could sit down and listen to each person's story, like, what's their why? Why are they here? And what did they have to go through in order to get to that start line? Oh, it's just...
And the motivation of why people are doing it, whether it be, you know, I think... What I take pride in the event is, yeah, it's grown. It's become a business. I'm not part of a business part of it. But what it's done for people, you know, the athletes, we see the physically challenged athletes, you know, with dismembered things, you know, war veterans out there that have brought themselves back. We see the first heart transplant patient. We see people that are cancer patients that I know personally, one lady that was getting chemo the day before she did the Ironman in Hawaii. But we see all these people with brain cancer. You know, we see the Hoyts, that, you know, the people with MS that, you know, tow somebody along in a boat, a bike, and on a run. I mean, it's just amazing what it's inspired other people to do.
I agree.
And I get choked up over that.
Yeah, I kind of am too. And that's one of the reasons why, although I'm not racing anymore, I'm still in it, because I love seeing the person that this challenge creates.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The person that who a person becomes because they've taken on not even just the race, but even the journey of the training, and they get to see how much, what they can handle and the strength that they have.
Right.
That's the real gem in all of this.
It teaches you not just the training part, but I think race day, it teaches you a lot about who you are as a person, you know, what you've gained getting there, but then doing the race and crossing that finish line.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I think it's a really, I'm sure there are other events out there that do the same, and they build character and help people realize how much strength they actually have, because they have to reach down to get that. I'm sure there are others, but this is a pretty powerful one too.
Oh, huge.
Yes. I want to do a little shout out to my team Triumph. This
is
an organization who, of course,
I'm very familiar with.
Yeah,
them.
they combine able-bodied athletes with disabled athletes.
Right.
So when you talk about seeing those teams out there on the course, I have a funny story about when I was on the course one time and they were on there, and I was so inspired. And I was in my dark spot, one of them. You know, there usually are many.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of like, oh, how am I ever? I was trying to PR that day, and how am I ever going to PR, and I don't feel great, I don't have the energy, and they came by me, and the crowd was just cheering them on, and I thought, oh my gosh, how can I feel sorry for myself in this moment when they are out here doing the same exact course I'm doing,
right?
And the angel is doing twice the amount of work, and the captain is cheering on the angel, and it's so inspiring, the inspiring stories all around on the day of the event.
I think you bring up a real valid point in doing Ironman, is everybody thinks that even you've done all this training, but you haven't put it all together. So you have to realize there's very few people that I have talked to that does not reach a dark spot at some point during the day. And I mean, there's days that I've had three or four dark spots in those 29 races that you have to overcome it. And that's why I say you have to keep moving forward. But I think one of the ways, and you brought up a very valid point about something inspired you to keep going. Well, in my races, when I reach those dark spots, like I say, they say laughter and humor are probably one of the best things for a release of tension and everything else. So that's why I talk to people when I'm out there. That's why I goof around and thank the volunteers. I feed off of spectators. I feed off of friends that are out there to support you. I feed off of the other athletes and stuff. And if it's not that, I feed off of something mentally. Mm-hmm. One of the mental things that I feed off of if I'm on the bike and I'm not feeding off of something there is my dad passed away, you know, probably just over a year after I had done the first race. Mm-hmm. So there's a memory there of my parents coming there to surprise me when I was at a dark spot on the first race. Mm-hmm. And this is one very emotional part that has always stuck with me. But between 17 and 22 miles on the run, I was in a dark place. I was literally crawling along. And when my parents came, I had no clue that they were coming. So all of a sudden, my support vehicle pulls alongside me at mile 22. And this guardrail is still there. And here I am crawling on a guardrail. And the doors open up. And here's my parents in this van. And I'm like, is this a mirage? You know, am I seeing things? Am I that far lost into this event? And they come out, my mom, you know, imagine being a parent, seeing your kid practically dying, you know, trying to finish this thing. And I was practically dying, you know, in the terms of how I felt, and my legs wouldn't, I couldn't barely stand up. My mom gives me a kiss and a hug and tells me that she loves me. But, you know, and I tell people, you know, guys are kind of funny as far as showing their emotions and stuff. And my dad always loved me, but, there were some hugs and, you know, stuff like that. But it wasn't, you know, the loving type that women give to their kids and stuff. So my dad comes up and he gives me a hug and tells me he loves me. And then he says, you know, he says, you can do this. Hmm. You know, he had belief in me. And, you know, being Christian, I looked up into the sky and stood up and got up and ran up the hill, down the hill, 4 miles, past two people and came in third. Well, where I was going to on this is when I have dark spots on the bicycle and stuff, I always think of my father still back then. And I think of one of the originals that had passed a pancreatic cancer that I was very close to. And I talk to them. I talk to people that, you know, were close to me, or people that, you know, are up there, and I say, hey, you know, how's it going? I need some strength today. As funny as that may sound, I'm sure there's other people out there that have stories when you're riding 112 miles, whether it's training or race day and stuff, of stuff that goes through your mind. So, yeah, so.
Absolutely.
And you have to get through. The bottom line is you have to find things or a way to get through those dark spots. And, you know, to everybody that's listening to this, everybody's been there, and it's how you handle that dark spot to keep moving on to get to that finish line.
Yeah. You know, one thing I try to remind my athletes is when you go into a dark spot, it's not because you've done something wrong. It's a long-ass day.
You're
going to have dark spots, and you're going to have, like you said, you're going to have more than one.
Cramping,
it's the way it is.
Whatever.
Yeah. And in the physical, you might get a cramp, and then it initiates the mental, and the mental says, oh, I didn't drink, I didn't eat, I'm stupid, I should have done this, or whatever thoughts come in. And so, I always want to remind the athletes that just because you go into a dark spot doesn't mean you did anything wrong.
Right.
It's just now you ask, what am I going to do to get out of it? And I think the memory of somebody that was important to you or an important moment that helped inspire you is a great way to do that. I have a friend who unfortunately lost her mom within months prior to one of her races. And she put the picture of her mom on her bike, on her handlebars
when
she did her race. And that was something that really
just
carried
keep looking
her
at
through.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, it
yeah.
was wonderful. And I know other people, they will write empowering words on their arm.
Yep.
Or have a playlist of songs in their head
right.
that they like to call upon.
Yeah.
Do you have any other things that you do that, you know, we're talking about mental practices here. And a lot of people don't think about
right.
prepping their mental practice.
Right.
They think about only training their physical form. So what other kinds of mental practices do you do?
Well, I think just in training alone, mentally, you have to realize that not every day is going to be your best day out there. So I think one of the things is you hope that you do have bad days, because that mentally prepares you for some of the obstacles or dark spots that you're going to have on race day. And you have to figure that out in training. One of the other things mentally you have to prepare yourself for is you have to prepare yourself to think on race day. And you brought up a good point. You have to remember mentally that this is a long day. I'm going to be out there a long time. I'm going to be hurting. I may cramp. So you have to remember to keep nutrition, drinking, stuff like that. Too many people get tired and all of a sudden they stop doing the things that they trained for and stuff on race day. And you can't do that. You have to do that. And the other mental thing that you have to do is, like I say, to mentally prepare yourself, you have to believe in yourself. You always have to keep saying, if you have a bad day training, oh, it's a bad day training, I'm going to do this. You know, you have to always be positive. Don't ever be negative on yourself for a bad training day, a bad race, or anything like that. Always keep yourself mentally positive and stuff, you know, strong. I can do this. I am doing this. You know, I was built to do this. You know, I'm going to do this.
Right. And I love what you said about if you're having a bad training day, let yourself acknowledge it's a bad training day.
Right.
It doesn't mean that you're a bad triathlete.
Right.
Or you're going
right.
to have another bad day on race
Great
day.
Point.
It was just
Great point.
A day.
Right.
Yeah.
But it could happen on race day.
It could.
And know that it could happen.
And building the confidence to know that you can manage and move through anything that happens
right.
on race day.
Right. Yeah. And even though you don't meet your expectation that you wanted to on race day, and this is another thing, and I've talked to you about this before, you know, probably one of the biggest things that I dislike when I'm at a race is when I see somebody and they're so upset with themselves, they don't talk to people the next day. You know, they finished the Ironman, they didn't either qualify for Kona or they didn't have their PR that they were looking for. And I look at them and I say, how can you be upset at yourself? Look at what you just accomplished. Just doing what you did and doing a 2.4 mile swim, 112 mile bike ride, and a 26 mile marathon and finishing it is an accomplishment in itself. Don't ever look down on yourself for doing it. Hold yourself in high esteem, be positive, and show that positive to everybody else so it inspires maybe somebody else to do it.
That's such a good reminder. Because we can get so skewed in our goals.
And you as a coach probably have seen that more than anybody else, that people have certain aspirations on race day and they don't meet it and stuff like that. And different people handle it and say, oh, yeah, I'll have a better time the next time.
Right.
And others just go into a deep
It hurts. It literally hurts my heart to see and hear people go into that negative place after they've just accomplished this amazing feat that 1% of the world's population actually does.
Does, yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know how it is for you. How many Ironmans have you done?
I've done five.
Five. And I know that we've shared two.
We
shared Wisconsin, and we had a destination race in Switzerland, which was excellent. But I still get emotional and get that great feeling when I go across the finish line. Do you still?
I do.
I can't sense how nobody crossing that finish line cannot get that sense, whether you've done one. I know a guy that's doing his 235th.
Gosh.
And he's still, John Rags his name, and he still gets that accomplishing his 235th Ironman at 66 years old.
Wow. Good for him.
Yeah.
And good for him for keeping it in perspective, too.
He does.
And keeping the gratitude. Yeah.
Yep.
When you did the 30th anniversary.
Yes.
which was your second Ironman officially.
Yes.
You came up with a big goal. That goal was to complete every race.
Oh, after the race.
Yeah, after that.
Yeah, after that, I had done that, and then I did the Ironman 70.3 World Championships in Clearwater, Florida. And then I went to Mexico by my good friend Luis Alvarez, who's doing his like 140th now. But he was on, he had just finished his 57th because I have the marker. And we were having, as they do in Mexico, a little tequila, talking stupid. And he says, oh, by the 35th anniversary, I'm going to do 100. So my tequila talk was, oh, I'm going to do every Ironman in the world in the next 5 years. And it wasn't that unattainable of a goal in perspective of things. But after accomplishing those two feats that I just accomplished, it's like, okay, what do I do now to, what's the next goal that you accomplish again? So I jokingly said, I'm going to do that. Well, I took off and tried to do that over the next 5 years.
And in that period of time, you found out that you had leukemia.
Correct. After about a year and a half, I found.
Yeah. That throws a little monkey wrench into those plans. How did you manage that news? And how are you managing that now?
Well, mentally, when I first got that, it was devastating. Think about you're the healthiest person around. You've done this, you've done that. And all of a sudden,
you've completed Ironmans.
Right. Yeah. And all of a sudden, they're telling you got leukemia. Hmm. And so I took it and dealt with it tough in the beginning. Then mentally, I says, I've seen people in worse shape than me. I'm just like you said with Team Triumph. Pick yourself up. I think one of the strongest things that I've pulled out of Ironman, and this dates back to 1978, is that there aren't no goals that you can't accomplish if you mentally and physically put your mind to it. Some people have physical challenges that they might not be able to, but an able-bodied person, that if you put your mind to doing something and that you can accomplish it. And Ironman has made me mentally strong to overcome, you know, adversity. Mm-hmm. And I think it also picks you up in your careers and stuff too, and makes you, I think one of the biggest things is it motivates you, you know, because I guess generally we are type A people and stuff to even attempt something like that. I think it gives you those motivations too in your career and pushing yourself past boundaries, saying I could do this or I could be this, or, you know, in school, you know, study harder if you're in college, and, you know, attain goals that you really want to.
Yeah. That reminds me of in my coaching, I talk about a step of creating transformation or change in life. And one of those steps is building the evidence. What you were talking about is in the races, you built the evidence that you can move through things, you can accomplish things, right. You can accomplish tough things, right, that require you to dig down deep.
Right.
And you've been able to transfer that into day-to-day living,
right,
which is the other thing that I love about Ironman. It's because you can take those, all those lessons and those skills that you put into the sport event and put them into the field of life.
I agree.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
So how are you doing that now how is your health now with leukemia, and how are you moving through that?
Well, the last Ironman I did was October of 2013. That was the 35th anniversary of Kona. And I was struggling that day. Just had some problems with my GI system, not being able to hold anything in and stuff like that. And at 9 miles of the run, I basically passed out, got taken to the med tent. 3 liters of fluid, that started my problems again with my leukemia, major problems with my leukemia and that. And one of the big things is infections, blood clotting and stuff like that. So I've had some major problems with it. I move along good, but I DNF'd. And you know what's really funny is people always look and say, you know, there's a stigma that goes with DNFing, did not finish, you know, that athletes put on it and that. And there are certain stigmas that maybe should be put on it. If If you DNF because you weren't mentally strong enough and you just quit, then that goes on you, you know? But if you DNF and you have some problems on race day and stuff like that, this is an event, okay? This isn't something that's worth losing your life over or anything like that.
Absolutely.
Listen to your body.
Be smart.
Be smart. Take the medical attention. It can cause, because of the demands on your body, it can cause so many problems to you later on in life. Don't look at it as a bad thing. Pick yourself up and say, okay, yeah, I'll do it again. You know, it was a little bit hard because that was the 35th anniversary and that, but I don't look at the fact that I quit it. I look at that I was taking medical. I had no other options.
Yeah.
And it did affect me. What happened to me that day did affect me for the last 4 years now.
Mm.
So I just share that because I know what it affected my immune system and all the problems I've dealt with for the last 4 years.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What are your goals moving forward?
Live life.
Live life.
Unlike Jill, I haven't committed myself to saying I've retired from this event.
Oh.
I laugh at Jill because I know I've known Jill, like you say, since 2008. And for her to say that I'm not going to do another one, I call like the movie, what was that movie? How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Bullshit. They're playing this card game and they hold up the cards and it was called bullshit. Well, I know that's going to happen with Jill. She'll do another one. But yeah, in all reality, my goals moving forward, first of all, it is live and enjoy life. Because of what I went through, I found peace in going to event and being able to enjoy it and cheer friends on and get the same enthusiasm and stuff from, you know, the spectators and from the athletes. I've also found that swimming for fun instead of training is fun.
It's fun. Swimming can be fun.
Swimming can be fun, especially open water swimming for fun, where you're not racing, you just get out there and you enjoy yourself. I've also found that in cycling. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm looking at a computer or cramming data or anything like that and worrying about what speed or what time to go on a nice ride and stop for lunch or stop for coffee and stuff like that. So that is another goal, to enjoy life that way. My major goal is to get back to Ironman in October of 2018 and do the 40th anniversary of Kona.
Okay.
That would be my major goal next year, is to hopefully have enough strength to overcome some of what I've gone through and to get there, start and finish, and make decisions from that point moving forward of whether I will do another Ironman or not and what it does to my body.
Yeah, and you'll be smart. You'll be smart.
Oh, totally smart.
Decisions.
Totally.
Absolutely.
Smart. Yeah, totally smart.
Yeah. You've done 29.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a huge bag full of experiences and knowledge.
Yeah.
So we all trust that you'll make good decisions around that. Absolutely.
And if not, we'll be having fun coffee rides and lunch rides.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things I love asking all of my interviewees is a favorite song, because I think music has the opportunity to really build us up. And so if you're going to be training for 2018 and you're listening to a song, what song lifts you up?
You know, I've shared this before. I'm not a person of music. I hear lyrics and stuff like that. But the one big song, because you're out on that bike so long and you're by yourself, and I've done all but one of the toughest Ironman courses and stuff, all but Lanzarote that you did. I've not done that one, but I've done Wales, St. George, and all those, and all the European races, and there's a lot of climbing. And so the one song that always goes through my mind when I'm climbing, or, you know, just on the course after a climb and I've gone down, is Ain't No Mountain High Enough. I just keep singing that to myself.
That's
an
awesome one.
Yeah, and the other thing I tell people is, you know, people always joke about it, but on top of that song, as I'm climbing in that, the one thing I always remember in my mind is, what goes up has to come down.
That's right.
So being a bigger person, I always descend so much faster than I climb.
There goes Dave.
Yeah, and I go flying by people, and they're going like, where's that guy going so fast?
Right. Does he have a motor on that thing?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to listen to a little bit of Ain't No Mountain High Enough then. But we're going to come on back, so stay with us, because we're going to come on back, and I have a couple more questions for Dave before we're done.
Okay, great.
Listen, baby.
And we're back. Love that song. And I have to admit that I've had that song on my mind more than once while I've been out on the bike, because it is, it's a perfect one. And it's kind of uplifting. So,
well, why don't you share with the podcast and me what your favorite song is?
Gosh,
because
I have a couple. You know, it kind of depends on which gear I'm in. If I'm in my fifth gear at the end of the race and I really need to boost myself up, it's AC/DC Thunderstruck.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. Maybe okay. We'll go into that one here.
Yeah.
That one really gets me. And I have a funny story, because in Switzerland, the same race that you and I were doing together, there were times when I was literally out there by myself. I couldn't see hardly any bikers around me. It was a pretty spread out course, and it was quiet. So, and there weren't spectators like they have here in North America. And
well, because you're out in these open fields,
yeah.
And you know, the beautiful mountains and stuff, and people aren't out there. They save it for the run course.
That's right. And
so you do have a lot
villages.
Of time by yourself in the villages, yeah.
And you'd be surprised how much you need to occupy your mind, because there's a lot of time by yourself. And technically, you can't talk to other people because it's considered drafting.
Yeah.
So I'm out there and I'm by myself and I'm thinking, all right, what am I going to think about? And I'm getting kind of bored. And I, off in the distance, I hear these cowbells that are around the necks of the cows, and it was like sweet, luscious water after not having drank anything in hours, and it dawned on me, I'm like, this is what they're talking about in the sound of music. You know, the hills are alive with the sound of music. It was literal in that song. I had no idea. So that song comes to me often when I'm on the bike too,
nice.
As cheesy and corny as it is, but it actually has some roots for me.
Yeah.
So here's a good question I want to ask you as we're starting to wrap things up today. What is it that you want our listeners to really get, especially our Ironman listeners, those who are new to the sport, maybe doing their first race, and those who are veterans who have been in the field for years?
I think one of the big things that I hear, in, and it's good and bad, you take it for what it's worth, is that too many people have wrapped their lives around Ironman and just training, and that's the only focus they have. It's affected families. It's affected relationships with people and stuff, you know, that their own focus. So I think one of the things that I think should be a point that people should remember is that it is a race. Keep it fun. Don't give up your life for it. And honestly, the first year that I went back in 08, I gave up a lot of things, you know, because I was really trying to do something special in Hawaii. And then when I got sick and realized that, hey, I'm not going to attain certain goals and stuff like that, I just started enjoying my life socially again. And people, it was funny, the comments that were made to me. It's like, oh, it's good to have Dave back.
Wow.
Because how many people are going to bed at 9 o'clock at night because they got a 5 o'clock swim session? So you're missing some of the social life there. A Saturday night when you should be spending it with friends and stuff, but you got a 20-mile run the next day, or a Friday night and you got a 100-mile bike ride on a Saturday. You know, try and find a balance. I think the word would be balance. Find a balance in your life, but don't forget your friends and family and stuff in doing Ironman. There's the 1% or 2% of them that are out there racing for money and for a career and stuff like that. The rest of us are out there, and it's for your own personal goals, for whatever it be, Kona slots, finishing, you know, PR times and stuff like that. So find the balance and keep the race in perspective.
That's a beautiful message. Thank you. What a great way to close out the podcast today. Yeah. Thank you so much.
That's great.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here and sharing your insights. Yeah. Your insights with us. Thank you, listeners, for being here today, too. I always like to end the interviews or any of the podcasts with a challenge for you. Yes. So what I'm going to challenge all the listeners to do today is find out a way, especially, let me say that differently. For our Ironman listeners, I want you to ask yourself how you can dial up the fun in your training and your racing. What fun element can you add into your regime today? Don't wait till tomorrow, add it today. If you're listening to this and you're not an Ironman athlete, I'm gonna challenge you to do the same thing. What's one thing you can do? How can you dial up the fun in your life and start living more out loud and live it lightly? There ain't no mountain high enough to keep us down. So if you're listening to this from my website, be sure to add your name to the notification list so we can let you know when the next podcast is ready for you. If you're listening to this from iTunes, please go to my website at jillmsummers.com and then click on the podcast page where you can easily add your name for continued notification. And a little plug I want to throw in there right now is I'm actually offering a mental skills program. It's called Ironman Mental Mastery. It's a 3-class program. It's 2 classes online and 1 class in person. And it's specifically for all of you athletes who are doing Ironman Wisconsin in just a couple of weeks from now. So you can find out more of that information on my website. I'd love to have you there. It's going to be a really awesome opportunity to build your mental game, which very few of us know how to do. And this is going to walk you through the steps to doing it so that you can get to your race day with less anxiety, more confidence, and the ability to go after that dream day that you've been practicing and preparing for. This is Jill with Jill M. Summers Performance Coaching. I am so grateful for you to be here listening today, and we'll see you on the next podcast.
Thanks for being with us today. We invite you to join us on our mission to move people forward and upward. Go to JillMSommers.com. That's JillMSommers.com for more information and to listen to other inspiring podcasts. And remember to do one thing today that moves your life forward, which impacts others around you to do the same.